The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The president called on Americans to fight for what he called the soul of the nation in his primetime speech last night. He accused former President Trump and his supporters of attacking American democracy.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic.
A CBS News poll finds more than half of registered Republicans consider themselves part of the MAGA movement.
Europe, fearing an energy crisis, got some bad news today. Russia announcing it will keep the Nord Stream pipeline shut down.
Well, now to China's effort to combat COVID outbreaks. Officials in the southern tech hub of Shenzhen extending curbs on certain public activities and spaces.
Shenzhen is on edge, fearing a full-blown lockdown as authorities there impose more COVID curbs. Restrictions have been expanded on dine-in services, entertainment, and public venues. Work-from-home orders have been issued for much of the city. Chengdu, the southwestern city with 21 million residents, is now in its second day of its lockdown.
If tens of millions of people in these cities are being locked down based on a few dozen confirmed cases, what is the standard for removing these lockdowns? I mean, does it literally have to be zero for a number of days? And I guess it would seem there's not really a path out of this if that's the threshold of, you know, just 80 cases or something.
Yeah, it's difficult to say. We're expecting that these COVID lockdowns are going to continue and the disruptions definitely to continue. Because the situation has gotten tighter, especially with the political reshuffle that's expected to happen in October, just in about 6 weeks from now. So already the clampdown has been happening all around Beijing as well as throughout the country. And there is no guarantee that if President Xi Jinping, who's expected to take a third term, does get his third term and stays in power, that the zero COVID policy is going to change at all. I mean, that's what I think a lot of people are hoping for after this big political reshuffle. But there is no guarantee that that would actually happen.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, the week started off weak for stocks in the U.S. as investors were still feeling the effect of a resolute Fed plan to curb inflation, as discussed at the Jackson Hole Economic Symposium last week. One of the FOMC voters this year, Cleveland Fed President Mester, said on Wednesday she thinks the Fed funds rate can be above 4% early next year, and she does not anticipate a quick pivot to cutting rates in 2023 either, specifically saying, "This will be painful in the near term, but so is high inflation." We've seen the probability of a 50 basis point hike versus a 75 basis point hike flip as a result of the Jackson Hole Symposium last week, and that probability remains elevated and in favor of a 75-point hike by the end of this week. Bearish sentiment on a restrictive Fed sent the indices through key intermediate support Tuesday, like the 50-day moving averages, despite the bulls making a heroic attempt to support stocks on Thursday with an intraday reversal and positive close for the S&P 500. And again on Friday, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ were unable to reclaim those key levels by the end of the week. Additionally, the rally Thursday was questionable, given the gains were in mega cap, with defensive sectors like healthcare and utilities leading performance, and with decliners leading advancers 5-2 on the NYSE and 5-3 at the NASDAQ. Non-farm payrolls were the major economic announcement this week on Friday, with an increase of 315,000. Average hourly earnings went up less than expected, but went up 0.3% month over month, and the unemployment rate ticked up to 3.7 from 3.5, mainly due to a jump in the participation rate to 62.4 from 62.1. While these figures were a step down from the hot employment data in July, it probably won't be enough to dissuade the Fed from raising, again, 75 points in September, with the probability at 58% last I checked Friday, according to the Fed Funds futures. Other important news in energy. Monday, Bloomberg reported that nuclear talks with Iran have been extended for a few weeks due to disagreements on important issues. That caused oil futures to rise 4.1% higher to 96.91 per barrel. The following day, Bloomberg reported that the EU will meet its gas storage goal 2 months ahead of schedule. And this caused oil futures to fall 5.5% to $91.60 per barrel by the end of the day, with gasoline falling 7% to $2.53 per gallon. In addition to the storage news, the European Commission President von der Leyen said they plan an emergency intervention to help fight rising energy prices. Last I checked, West Texas oil was trading down at $86.61, near the lows for August mid-Friday. Earnings reports this week were mixed. On the positive side, Lululemon beat expectations and raised guidance with the stock up 9% last I checked. Best Buy and Big Lots also had favorable quarterly results with positive investor responses to their stock. Snap's better-than-expected revenue guidance also helped to rally the beaten-up stock. And on the flip side of earnings, HP Inc. and Seagate issued disappointing guidance and negative stock investor responses were seen in their stock. But it paled to the losses in some of the growth stocks this week, Okta and MongoDB, with huge double-digit stock percentage losses post their earnings announcements. To sum up the week, energy prices slid after hearing about the results in future plans for energy in Europe. And while the jobs data is headed in the right direction, to help the Fed lean towards maybe being less aggressive with its rate hikes, it was nowhere near recession levels and could be interpreted as still strong. That's why, despite the rally in stocks, we still saw predictions for a 75 basis point hike, which remains high, and the favored route the Fed is likely to take come the end of September.
With the financial sanctions that the Western world has just imposed on Russia, Russia can no longer trade in US dollars, right, or in euros. Russia really has no choice but to trade in renminbi. So what you've just witnessed in the past 6 months is the world number one commodity exporter and the world number one commodity importer have shifted their trade from US dollar to renminbi. Now, this has allowed China to turn around and ask people, tell people like BHP, the big Australian iron ore and copper producer, hey, BHP, I really like your stuff, but I can get the same stuff for Russia in renminbi. So unless you're willing to do a deal in renminbi, I'm just going to buy less from you and more from Russia. And so 4 weeks ago, BHP did its first deal in renminbi for iron ore, which now allows China to turn to Rio Tinto, to Vale, and say, hey, by the way, unless you follow BHP's terms, I'm going to do more with them and less with you. So what I'm highlighting is behind all the bearishness of China and the bullishness on the US dollar lies another reality, that is that the commodities trade is rapidly shifting in front of our eyes.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
For many decades, the global economy experienced a dramatic expansion in the working age population. One of the biggest impacts this had was to lower the cost of nearly every type of manufactured good, something we experienced for about 40 years from around 1980 up until the year 2020. Unfortunately, that multi-decade process of ever-increasing globalization, aided by an ever-increasing expansion of new workers, is now reversing. Today on Financial Sense NewsHour, we are going to re-air probably one of the most important interviews we conducted this year on our weekday FS Insider podcast a few months back with Manoj Pradhan, who, along with Charles Goodhart at the London School of Economics, wrote a must-read book in 2020 we have cited many times on our show called The Great Demographic Reversal. It discusses the many implications of falling birth rates around the globe, not the least of which is a long-term increase in the rate of inflation. This book and much of what we discuss in today's interview is part of why we've been consistently warning on Financial Sense NewsHour, at least since 2020, to prepare for higher inflation for many years to come, if not for the remainder of this decade. If you haven't already read this book, we would certainly encourage you to listen to many of the very compelling arguments that Manoj makes in today's show some of which are quite shocking when you consider the numbers that he cites. As always, if you'd like to hear more of these types of interviews we offer on FS Insider during the week, covering all aspects of the markets and the economy, as well as long-term macro trends as we discussed today, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. Manoj Pradhan is the founder of the independent research firm Talking Heads Macroeconomics, based in London. He, along with Charles Goodhart at the London School of Economics, wrote a must-read book in 2020 that we have cited many times on our show, called The Great Demographic Reversal: Aging Societies, Waning Inequality, and an Inflation Revival. Even today, nearly 2 years after its release, it is still listed as one of the highest-ranking books on Amazon when it comes to macroeconomics, public policy, and business finance. So, Manoj, before we jump into the crux of your argument and how you see things proceeding in the years ahead, would you mind giving our listeners a 30,000-foot view of what we're seeing globally in terms of this great demographic reversal?
So the story starts actually quite a few decades ago. And in our book, it starts with the integration of China into the global economic system. A lot of attention has been paid to the baby boomers and the advanced economies and their integration into the labor force. But an even greater story played out when Eastern Europe, and particularly China, started joining the global manufacturing and trading system. And if you look at the mathematics of it, the integration of China after the granting of the most favored nation status in 2000 by the US Congress effectively led to a 120% increase in the global labor supply of the manufacturing system in the world. I mean, there's been nothing like it ever before. In the positive side, the only example that one can really think of that is even close is the Black Death, and that decimated about a quarter of the world's labor force and really sent wages skyrocketing in a very short period of time, as you would expect. The China force was a much slower story. And effectively, if you want to think about it, the best way to think about it is that China set the global equilibrium wage, because that was always a threat. We can manufacture cheaper in China, and people did. And so global wages started converging to the Chinese manufacturing level. The second thing that happened is that through a system of financial flows, with China blocked at its borders, Western companies effectively had only one way to take advantage of China's massive subsidies and the labor force advantages that it had, which was to produce on Chinese shores. So the Pearl River Delta, which was really a marshland in the 1970s, slowly but surely became the 10th most populous region in the entire world. And it was packed with multinational companies and state-owned enterprises that really took advantage of this influx of entrepreneurship, capital, and technological transfers. So over the last 30 or 35 years, the combination of China's and Eastern Europe's integration and the joining of the baby boomers created and huge demographic sweet spot. And it was no surprise, as you would expect from basic economics, that when you increase the supply of a good or a commodity that aggressively, its price inevitably drops. And so we got a decline in wage growth, we got a decline in inflation. And that process actually started reversing sometime around 2010. But one of the key stories about global macroeconomics is, until the whole world turns, you don't really start seeing those effects. So the book, which you very kindly quoted, was actually written before the pandemic. And we saw these demographic forces changing, but we didn't know to within 5 or 10 years when inflation would show up. As it turned out, just as we were about to publish the book, the pandemic hit. And what we saw happening was a pretty dramatic fast tracking of some of the trends that we expected would have happened over decades, we thought would happen within a matter of years. And so we argued in March of 2020 that after a vaccine was introduced or COVID retreated, within 12 months or so, we would see inflation somewhere in the 5 to 10% range because there would be labor shortages and because supply effects would dominate. And that's really been the crux of our argument, that we've seen things from a global standpoint. We've seen things from a supply side, whereas people like Larry Summers have made excellent points, but all from the demand side, which can be better managed by central banks. Our argument is a lot harder to deal with. And I think that's the crux of the story, that inflation over a period of time will rise as we see structural labor shortages. And part of the intuition there is that, look, workers produce. and they consume less than they produce, which means they're disinflationary. But people who join the ranks of the dependents, the elderly, consume but don't produce, and they turn out to be inflationary. And as the dependents start dominating the delta of the population and workers become more scarce, you get less disinflation, more inflation, which means you get hit with a structural uptick in inflation, which we're just not prepared for.
So I want to focus in on the supply-demand side argument here, because as you noted, central bankers, policymakers, they're really focused on the demand side by raising interest rates and squashing inflation by trying to lower the demand for goods. But as you noted, what we're looking at is really a supply-side phenomenon. Central bankers, policymakers, they have very little control over that side of the equation.
I think you put it very well. And I think the story really is akin to what a lot of people worry about in emerging markets, right? In emerging markets, there's an old phrase that says it's not the speed that kills you, it's the sudden stop. Well, this is kind of the same thing, except in a structural sense. So after a 30-year period where we've had abundant labor supply and an increasing amount of globalization and China expanding the manufacturing capacity in every which way you can think of, suddenly, all of these things have come to a grinding halt. They have even been thrown into partial reversal in some cases because of the recent stagflationary shocks that we've received from Russia and Ukraine. But more, it has been that supply simply has not been able to keep up with demand. So just think of opposite Nike swoosh, if you will, which is the downtrend in inflation was fostered by benign demographic forces. And suddenly we've been hit by the supply shortages, which in a relative sense just lagged demand, but from a perspective of inflation, it's as if there was not enough supply in the world. And you're right, central bankers can't really do anything about it. I think they realize this, and all they're trying to do is to narrow the gap between demand and supply. That's the best they can do. The problem is, to the extent that supply just doesn't respond, you have to keep hitting demand and keep hitting demand and keep hitting demand until you get that narrowing. Effectively, it's not that we meet halfway, so supply expands a fair bit or expands by much more than you'd expect, and demand falls a little, so we come to this benign scenario where you get a soft landing and everything works out happily. That scenario simply has given us no hope at all. And so what we may have to do is keep hammering down demand until it meets supply, and that would mean a harsher recession than most are expecting today. I'm not sure central banks are prepared for it. And in fact, if you look across the world, others besides the Fed are already beginning to wonder how far they can go. The Bank of England is very far behind and continues to fall further behind because they keep hiking in 25 basis points. The European Central Bank is under very difficult conditions because of the gas supply shocks and the possibility of retaliation by Russia to any actions that they may take on Russian oil prices. And so it's become a lot more complicated for economies around the world, primarily because they have waited so long to close that gap.
Now, I know that you put most of the emphasis on China. However, as you know, there is a major demographic reversal. Is this a crucial part of this issue that we're facing as well? Or is China really the brunt of what you see essentially moving us to a place of reverse globalization and higher inflation? Can you sort those things out for us just in terms of the role of China versus global demographics as a whole?
So on the way down for inflation, which by which I mean the last 30 or 35 years, the China impulse was certainly the most aggressive. And in fact, China's rise has been the standout factor over the last three decades. There's no doubt about it. We all know this story. But what changes now is that it's not just China that is reversing its demographic trends, but the entire manufacturing complex is now moving in the same direction towards an aging society where the number of workers who will join the workforce will gradually fall, and the number of elderly, particularly those who are really old and at higher risk of neurodegenerative diseases and hence caring, start dominating the demographic footprint. So while we saw China as the one factor that really accelerated the entire demographic sweet spot and the demographic dividend that the world received in the last 30 or 35 years, now it's a more collective move towards an aging society and a global economic system with a much smaller number of workers when you look at the global footprint of who generates growth.
And I believe, as you've pointed out in the past and in your book, India and these emerging economies, like you noted, even Indonesia, for example, which has a very young and booming workforce, they're not enough to offset the demographic decline in China or globally.
Numerically, I think we may be able to achieve it. So, you know, when we've all gone through our economics classes, right, particularly when you're doing graduate economics, you're given this model of a benevolent dictator who would reassign roles between labor and capital and global flows would be free. If you did that, I think you might be able to flatten the global demographic picture out, because sub-Saharan Africa, and as you correctly pointed out, India, Indonesia, some parts of Latin America, these still have a population that's growing. They have a very young population, they could change the demographic landscape. The problem is that globalization is in retreat, and in particular, migration of people from labor surplus economies into aging economies is not fluid. And because it's not fluid, we then have to try and think about taking advantage of these young populations in India and Indonesia and Africa in another way, which is to say, okay, look, if we can't import labor from there to look after the elderly here, can we export capital to those countries, transform it into output, and then bring it back to our countries? Because actually, that's what we did with China. So why not do it with these countries? Well, there are two problems there. Number one, the administrative capital and the administrative will in these economies is not close to the Chinese system, where you could really force the state-owned enterprises to take a monochromatic approach and just do as the center was telling you and apply all the subsidies and resources you can towards that process. India, with its democratic setup, has a fair amount of conflict between the center and the states. You get a very different story in Africa, which is a continent of 50 countries, where if you wanted to rival China with the workforce that you've got, you would need an alignment of 50 national strategies. And that just sounds really difficult to do. So I think these countries will do well. The ones that have a good system of turning incoming capital into output will continue to boost their per capita GDP. They'll continue to show promise over a period of time. And that's why there's so much interest in India. There's so much promise coming out of some African countries. But I don't think they have enough economic firepower to reverse what is going on in the rest of the world. They'll do very well themselves, but I don't think they can bail the world out.
Yeah, and something that we do see in China, which is not repeatable in other parts around the world, is their ability to essentially engage collective action for these large-scale projects, right? I mean, that's something that is very unique to China, whether or not you're looking at the Great Wall of China or their industrialization of their economy, the building of many cities within a very short period of time. That is something that seems unique to China that I would agree with you. I don't think we could see repeated in many of these other countries over a short period of time like we saw over the past 30, 35 years.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it takes a central, if you will, almost a centralized regime that pushes through projects. Even talking about India, you can have large-scale projects that are planned by the state, but all it takes is a legal challenge by residents living in that place, and the case can go on for years. So in fact, what that sets up is a state competition to attract capital by providing easier regimes in which you invest in. And that doesn't necessarily lead to an optimal allocation, because if the allocation was optimal to begin with, you wouldn't need to compete in that sense. Capital would just flow to the right places. So I think you're absolutely right on that front.
Given that, how long could we expect this trend to last, a great demographic reversal and then some of the implications from this? I mean, is this something that will likely take years to play out, or are you looking at this more on the scale of decades?
I think the demographic reversal plays out on the scale of decades. What can happen is if some of those trends get entrenched into financial markets, they could get fast-tracked over a much, much, much shorter period. So for example, what we see as lessons to learn from COVID are that the elderly are a political force to be reckoned with. When it comes to their well-being, it's very difficult in a positive sense or in a normative sense, for governments to walk away and say, well, you're on your own. It just doesn't happen. And what that tells us is that as the society ages and the needs of the elderly, whether it's simple care or caring for those with neurodegenerative diseases, becomes more and more of a macro issue simply because of an increase in the number of people who have to deal with these stories, governments will not be able to walk away from them. So if you look at the CBO's projections, for example, the increase in debt during the pandemic is not really a big deal when you look at the increase in debt that they are expecting over the next 30 years. And much of that is related to aging and the process of caring for older people. So suddenly we get an intertwining of demography, of politics, and of financial markets. If we are to care politically speaking for an aging population, that caring needs to be financed. And for financing that story, financial markets need to be on board. And for financial markets to be on board, particularly at the time that debt to GDP starts accelerating, we need to see an end game in sight. And that means financial markets have to deem that increase in debt to GDP sustainable. They have to see that it is going to be financed either through taxation, very difficult to do, through some other kind of process where you can change the way debt is redeemed. And most likely, some of that, we're not saying all of it, some of that is going to be redeemed through inflation. So once those stories get entrenched, we might get a fast tracking either of inflation coming in a lot faster or of the credit spreads on all assets moving up a little bit more as the risk in the economy changes, or even a fiscal crisis. And once these kind of situations get fast-tracked, we see a resolution which could then go towards far more benign path. But the problem will come before the solution.
So there are things that can be done on the fiscal and monetary side in addition to what you just outlined. But it would appear to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's really not much that can be done to incentivize societies to have more children, because that has been tried in the past. It's not been very successful. Even China is struggling with that by relaxing their one child to two child, now their three child policy. But even then, people are still having lower amounts of children just for forces that are outside of their control. Can you delve into that a little bit, at least in terms of, you know, rate of childbirth and how much control there is there?
I'd be happy to. And I'll add one more thing at the end that, I think perhaps we need to spend a little bit of time on as well. But let's answer your question first. I think you're right. It's been very, very, very difficult once you slow down into a small sustainable family unit to then start expanding the family unit, particularly in places where the cost of living is high to begin with. And one or two children has really done the job reasonably well as far as sustainability is concerned. In China in particular, the realization that they need to move to a larger family unit has come a little too late. But let's go with the counterfactual, right? Let's say that they are successful in increasing the number of children that each family has for the next 20 or 25 years. That would actually mean that the dependency ratio goes up. There is some hope because at the end of 20 years, those kids will join the labor force. But in the meantime, the government will have to be prepared to subsidize those families while they raise their children, and in the meantime, fight off the onslaught of and burgeoning ranks of the elderly. So it's not a simple problem, even if we decide to go that way, and we do end up solving and successfully incentivizing families to have more kids. Until they join the labor force, the dependency ratios, and therefore the pressure on the families, and therefore indirectly on the government, will actually increase. So what we then have to do is we then have to start relying on non-policy stories like technology, or perhaps even a cure for neurodegenerative diseases by way of which we've seen next to nothing so far. If either of those stories played out to fruition, we'd have a much more optimistic future. At this point in time, I don't think they're adequate.
What are some of the major implications that you believe this has long-term when it comes to some of the things that are mentioned in the very title of your book, regards to globalization, inflation, and other key areas?
The first one, as we started our discussion with, is inflation. So as we see the number of elderly becoming larger and a larger share of the population, their consumption will outstrip their production, which is next to nothing, And that will mean that you get an inflationary impulse that is very difficult to offset. Again, as I said, unless technology really goes through the roof from here. The number of workers, on the other hand, will get smaller and smaller, and they would be expected to not only fend for themselves, but also to somehow partly pay for aging and for healthcare for the elderly. And so as the taxes to make that transfer from workers to non-workers becomes larger, the workers will then start to demand an after-tax wage that protects them. And that is an inflationary process by itself, not to mention that the debt you and I discussed some time ago will have to be financed somehow, most likely through inflation. So the first thing we can expect is inflation to be a part of our future. It need not be rampant. It need not be at incredibly high levels, but I think it's unrealistic to assume that inflation will remain as low as it has for the last 15 years before the great financial crisis, even afterwards for cyclical reasons, and certainly for the last 30 or 35 years. I think we have to leave that disinflationary story behind and think of a world in which inflation is somewhat higher. As I said, that's not all bad. It's just that financial markets are not pricing this. And most people, as we can see today, are not ready for inflation spikes. The second thing that happens is a more benign story, because as you start running out of workers, companies suddenly find that they need to protect their profitability. So we are expecting a pickup in productivity because companies start deploying capital to start trying to replace labor. And what that gives you is better bargaining power from a labor's point of view, greater pressure on capital and asset returns. And the end game then suggests, as we say in the title of our book, inequality starts falling. It doesn't fall aggressively. It doesn't fall against a very benign backdrop of rampant and strong growth with low inflation, but it does provide some offset for some of the problems we've created for ourselves over the last 30 years.
So when it does come to inflation as a byproduct of this demographic reversal, as you argue, we could be looking at higher than average inflation for not just years, but perhaps on the order of decades ahead.
I think that's true. I mean, we can't be 100% sure that it will last certainly for decades because, as I said, a realization that something needs to change, which usually follows a crisis, could change policymaker attitudes. There could be a wholesale revamping of tax regimes, of the way we trade, of the way we treat debt and equity, of the way we treat inflation, how central banks think about what they can control and what they cannot control, going back to your point on demand and supply. All those things could happen. You know, we could raise retirement ages dramatically, but we've all seen that usually that precipitates a crisis. And so these realizations may all come upon us, but for them to collectively be in the works probably requires a fairly volatile period, which we're not prepared for. So it could happen for years, it could happen for decades, it could happen slowly, and it could happen far more rapidly. The only thing I think we can be sure about is the future is nothing as benign as the past was.
Now, as you know, Jay Powell at the Fed, Janet Yellen at the Treasury, and most officials completely missed the mark on inflation. I know members of the IMF have reviewed your book and that it has gained attention of those in the central banking and policymaking spheres. Are you starting to see a greater recognition of some of the arguments that you and Charles made in your book, or is there any pushback or resistance that you're getting to it?
I do think there is a growing realization that we have been perhaps too demand-focused. And part of the reason was, as we described, the supply shock has been so benign that we've almost been able to disregard it. We considered globalization and China to be synonymous, and it's difficult to extricate one from the other, but there have been strong supply stories that have helped the world look a far more benign picture than will be the case in the future. And so central banks are coming to grips with it a little bit. I think they still look a little bit more cyclically than structurally at that story, but I cannot deny that they have indeed started taking a look at it. President Bostich of the Atlanta Fed was very kind to invite Charles and myself to give a keynote at their annual conference, which was very well received. I think he was very appreciative of the arguments that we brought to the table. We have presented to the ECB at the Sintra conference and also at the Austrian Central Bank conference very recently in May. There has been some quoting of our books at the highest levels of the ECB. It has been quoted by central banks across the world. We have presented in Scandinavian economies, and I think there is some realization as the world ages that we can't just look at the demand side of the story. We also need to integrate the supply side. So all of that is very heartening. I would love to see more of that get formalized, which I don't believe it has been. Right now, it's just an intriguing topic, but there is no clear consensus, as far as I can see, within policy circles about how they need to formally integrate this within their thinking and how to formally address it on a regular, consistent basis. So it becomes part of the conversation with financial markets and with ordinary people. That still remains to be done.
It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but at the policymaking level and perhaps among economists, the counterexample that's often given to aging demographics and an inflationary outlook is Japan, right? So Japan saw a rapidly aging population, and yet they saw decades of disinflation. What would you say about that?
Well, it's the most basic question that everyone who thinks about demography must ask. In fact, it's something that we decided to answer before we wrote the rest of the book. And Charles and I decided that until we had a definitive answer for the Japan question, there really was no point in proceeding with the rest of the book. In other words, we set ourselves a threshold of saying, is Japan really the roadmap for the future? If it is, then our argument carries no merit in net terms, at least. It may have a gross argument, but the net terms would not work for us. As it turns out, our view on Japan is very different from what others have. The problem with most analysis of Japan is that people have considered what behavioral economists would call a narrow framing approach, which is that they consider two factors. They look at the end game in Japan and say that those two factors, both domestic in nature, must be responsible for explaining what we see in Japan. So you look at Japanese growth and inflation on the one hand, and you look at Japanese demography on the other hand, and you say, well, lower growth and disinflation coincided with demography, and hence one must explain the other. And we think that's a very autarkic way of framing the problem. The way we saw Japan is that Japan's demography turned at a time when the rest of the world was swimming in labor, predominantly because of the impact that Japan's neighbor China had on the global economy. Now, Japanese corporates, if you look at the data from their ministry, which was meant to promote industry and exports and trade, the data from them suggests that the Japanese corporate sector, which is often painted as a slumbering beast, burdened by massive amount of debt they had deployed, was actually not sleeping. They were very aware of the situation. They used outbound FDI, which is a topic that is treated very separately in Japan, as a tool to escape a lot of the problems that were rightly present in post-bubble Japan. They used China not only as a huge market, but as a massive resource in terms of cheap labor that simply was not available anywhere else. And so from that perspective, outbound FDI meant that Japanese corporates actually produced, employed, and continued to make an outdoor presence in China to a much greater extent. So outbound FDI effectively became an escape valve that Japanese corporates used very intelligently to avoid the problems that they saw in Japan. The second bit of evidence that we get that Japan was actually a very different story from what the world imagines is when you look at the debt profile, the interest rate profile, and the debt servicing profile of Japan. We think of Japan's debt, massive as it is, as a very unique story. But in our book, particularly in the chapter on debt, we've got a set of six charts that shows you the advanced economies. And to be honest with you, if you ignore the levels, which is not something I would advise you to do all the time, but for this particular point, if you ignore the levels of debt in Japan, the trends in debt, the trends in interest rates, and the trend in debt service ratios in Japan look exactly the same as the other advanced economies. In other words, Japan was not immune to the disinflationary impact that China had, Quite the contrary, they took advantage of China's introduction into the global economic system and used it to escape some of the problems with Japan. The difference is, as we discussed with India and Africa, there are no outlets today. So Japan is aging at a time when the entire manufacturing complex is also aging. That makes it very hard to get a replica of what happened in Japan anywhere else in the world. There is just no escape. I don't think we should treat Japan as a roadmap for the future, but as a very individual story that happened against a completely different global demographic backdrop, which we are just not facing today.
Now, on that note, when we look at Japan, and I think you explained that very well, and I appreciate you going into that. One thing that is also cited that Japan did to alleviate some of the problems of their aging workforce is a heavy use of robots and automation. You did cite this before as something that could offset some of the inflationary impacts that would come from this. So how much of a role do you think we could see if the world were to move heavily into the robotization and the automation of the global workforce?
It's an incredibly difficult question to answer because in some senses, some of the promise of the breakthroughs is something that I think is almost impossible to chart. I mean, the applications that AI could potentially have and technology could potentially have seem very difficult to calculate. And yet, in some senses, we are overestimating the impact that robotics can have when we incorporate the resources that aging is going to use up. Let me explain why. The dependency ratios that we see increasing over the next 20 or 30 years in the manufacturing complex of the world understate the problem of aging. The reason they do that is because we haven't yet taken into account that an increasing number of the existing or the remaining workforce will be required to look after the elderly. And that means we need manufacturing to see greater and greater jobs being shed. We need services sector to see greater and greater number of jobs being shed. And all the jobs that can be automated through AI and robotics really should be automated away. So we need automation. We need technology. And we need AI to destroy as many jobs as is possible, because we are simply not incorporating how many jobs will be required and how much reallocation of labor is going to be needed in the future to look after the elderly. Now, if we had open immigration and we had open doors policies, that story, as we discussed for India and Africa, would have been alleviated to a great extent. But we don't have that option. And so technology is more of a complement to our story at the moment. If that changes, if we get these exoskeletal suits where the elderly are completely taken care of as far as physicality is concerned, and we get a combination where medical science reaches some kind of a breakthrough in dealing with neurodegenerative diseases, then I think we may be in for a better future. And in some senses, we would be absolutely thrilled to be wrong. I'm in my early 50s now. If these breakthroughs show up in the next decade or so, I'm looking at a much happier future. And it'll be one thesis that I would be thrilled to get completely wrong. I don't think we're seeing that future yet, but we're hoping that some of it does develop against our own expectations.
So Manoj, again, you are the founder of the independent research firm Talking Heads Macroeconomics. Of course, you tie the large macro outlook into, you know, what are some of the actionable investment implications that come from this. You know, boil this down for us. What are some of the key investment implications from the great demographic reversal, what we've discussed so far, that you are telling your listeners and subscribers to your research?
Well, there are really two sets of financial implications, one that is structural and the other one that is pervasive at the cyclical level. And I'll try and bring both of those in for you. At the structural level, I think the demography story is very, very well understood when it comes to an increasing demand for healthcare, a change in how the consumption basket is going to move. But broadly speaking, I think it's very poorly understood when it comes to the path of interest rates. If you're even partly right about inflation and bonds start responding to that persistent inflation over a period of time, a lot of the flows that have gone into bond markets will then also cease, or they will slow down dramatically. And that could be an accelerator mechanism. So the first thing we need to think about is dealing with bond yields that remain higher for a longer period of time. Number two, we need to start thinking about central banks that first try to fight and then accept modest inflation over a period of time. And that means we have to lose a little bit of the faith that central banks have encouraged us to take over the last 30 years. If Charles and I are right, and a lot of the disinflation over the last three decades was definitely due to better monetary policy, but also due to benign demography, then central banks have a lot less control over inflation than all of us believe at this moment. And that loss of belief will come at its own price. So we'll start bringing in risk premia into all asset prices, which means the returns on many risky assets will not be as fantastic. Third, the good news stories, part of which I already spoke about before, are where aging and aging populations will demand an increase in the number of services, but also where new areas of productivity will be found. So for example, right now, education and services in the United States are looked upon as very low productivity areas. I don't really like that definition because I feel that the higher footprint of labor is because of the idiosyncratic nature of these goods. But we will start to see more innovations in that sector as the demand for those services becomes higher. Similarly, emerging markets have an ability to really outperform. Emerging markets haven't emerged almost by definition because they're inefficient. But because they're inefficient, they have a chance to address those inefficiencies and grow faster than the rest of the world. And they can deliver a real rate of return that many other places will find it hard to match. So we have some ways to try and combat the changes that are coming through demography. The near-term solution is to try and keep a very, very close eye on the Phillips curve. And the Phillips curve is this relationship between growth and inflation, or unemployment and inflation, which many have mostly dismissed, including the Federal Reserve. They believe that even if growth is very strong or unemployment is very low, we won't get higher inflation, even though that has not worked at all over the last 2 years. Most central banks still believe that the Phillips curve is dead. I think we have to be very vigilant and try and figure out where the Phillips curve is most active and whether it is actually getting damp again. If it doesn't, then what we are likely to get is a far more volatile set of business cycles. And that means greater volatility also in financial markets. We need to be prepared for that. We need to find out where central banks are ahead of the curve. For example, everyone looks at the Federal Reserve, but I would argue that places like Brazil, Mexico, New Zealand, and Korea are actually far more advanced because they have created the kind of damage to the economy that can bring down inflation over the next 2 years, 3 years with a far greater degree of confidence. Whereas if you look at places like Sweden and Australia, they're so far behind that catching up aggressively is something that it seems almost unthinkable that they will not do, but the bulk of the challenge lies ahead of them. The Federal Reserve is somewhere closer to the front of that queue, but it is not right at the tip. And if investors want to take advantage of who has done more, who has done less, they need to start thinking globally.
Manoj, one last question on investment implications from this. You know, when most people think about a long-term inflationary outlook, one of the first places that would be cited to hedge this risk would be through commodities. And there has been increasing talk over the past 2 years about us entering a new commodity super cycle. What would you say about that?
Well, look, this is one of the times where commodity prices are rising, but no one really wants to invest in supply. Most commodity cycles, long-term cycles, take place when commodity prices start rising. You see an increase in supply. That supply usually becomes a story of oversupply. Commodity prices fall. Capacity starts to stop being something that most firms invest in, and you get the whole cycle playing out again. This is a more unique story in that commodity prices are going up, but their future right now rests in whether central banks can get demand back in line with supply. To the extent that most people believe still that central banks are in charge. They do know what they're doing, and they will restore inflation over the next year or two back to targets. It also implies that they believe that central banks will be able to dampen demand to get it more in line with supply. And so hence, we won't really see a massive increase in commodity prices. If you look at the last few months, there's been a pretty big divergence in the trends in commodity markets, where oil prices have gone up, but other commodity prices have not. And so this becomes a slightly different story that is partly predicated upon what is happening within Russia and Ukraine, partly dependent on what central banks are delivering, and partly about the uncertainty that rests in the global economy at this point in time. I would argue that we are likely to see commodity prices modestly changing over a structural horizon, where some amount of growth in emerging markets might drive more industrial metals a little bit higher. And the search for alternate energies will probably accelerate from here, even though it's not a story for right now. And the reason is, well, you know, the old saying that the cure for high oil prices is high oil prices. Once we've got this kind of a shock, most people don't want to be dependent on such supply chains in the future. And that means even though ESG and the like are really taking a backseat at the moment, those stocks aren't doing very well compared to energy stocks and returns. I think that story will take up a prime position for geopolitical reasons in the future as well. So there's a lot going on in the commodity complex. I think we need to monitor those trends, but this might just be one of those unique cycles in which commodity prices don't really encourage CapEx in those sectors. And that's not a very good thing.
Okay, so when it comes to the great demographic reversal and the potential for higher than average inflation levels for not just years, but potentially up to a decade or more ahead, that doesn't directly translate into a high conviction call on a commodity supercycle.
No, because it's not a high growth environment. So what happens over here is that growth is, as we know, a sum of the growth of the labor force and the growth rate of productivity. And while the growth of the labor force is going to slow down quite a lot, productivity isn't going to rise dramatically. So you don't get a massive expansion in output. And in some senses, this stagflationary environment that we're in gets projected into the future at modest levels. But it's not something that necessarily raises massively the demand for commodities. And that's why we think the commodity story is not necessarily what's going to drive inflation up. If that was the case, we could solve it with an increase in supply that could be mandated by the government, and we'd be home and safe.
Is there anything that we didn't cover in today's interview, either regarding your book or your macro outlook, that you'd like to share with us before we close?
No, I think we've covered most of it extremely well. The only thing I would argue is something that we've already discussed, is that most policymakers, most people in financial markets, and most people in general do find demography a fascinating story. But, you know, for anyone who remembers their macroeconomic education, anyone who's going through graduate school right now, anyone who's reading economics books for out of interest or out of professional or personal interest, just ask yourself how much demography and supply side issues feature in those textbooks or in those discussions. And the answer is not enough. So while the story is a slow moving story, which is mid-trend, or towards the end of a trend that we understand very well, it's okay to ignore those structural changes because we've already incorporated that into our thinking, into our economies, into policymaking, and into models. But when we're at a transition point, the amount of importance we need to give and the humility we need to have about things we don't understand, I think is not at the point where it needs to be. I think we need to up the ante over here. We need to start paying a lot more attention to slow-moving structural change, to global issues, and to supply-side stories. And I'm just hoping that this becomes a trend which becomes entrenched in our thinking.
So, Manoj, in sum, we are witnessing a great demographic reversal with aging societies, especially with what we see taking place in China, the leading manufacturing powerhouse for the world. And what you are looking at is not just years, but potentially, you know, up to even on the order or scale of a decade or more of higher than average inflation. It's going to be volatile for markets. The global economy is not going to look like it did over the prior 30 to 35 years. And so there's a number of very key implications that come from this that you outlined today and that you also outline in your book. With that said, how can our listeners, aside from picking up a copy of your book, which I would highly recommend, how can our listeners follow more of your excellent research?
We do try to write on VoxEU. We do try to have a few letters that we send to financial newspapers. And of course, we'd love to be back on your show again. And if there's anything that we can do to keep the dialogue going, I'd be very happy to facilitate that. I just hope things turn out the way most people want. It looks like a difficult environment, but I'm very happy to be back on your show and try and talk to you and to try and address this issue in a more public way into the future. But I did want to take a second to thank you for having me here. I did want to take a second to thank you for drawing attention to these issues. And in particular, I wanted to thank you for having such a holistic view of the problems that we face, not just the very narrow issue of how financial markets are going to deal with it, but bringing into the discussion the matters about policy, the matters about how our lives will change, and how the society as a whole that we live in needs to start addressing these. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope we can do it again.
Manoj Pradhan, founder, independent research firm, Talking Heads Macro, based in London. And he, along with Charles Goodhart, London School of Economics, wrote a must-read book. We highly recommend you pick that up. And Manoj, we look forward to speak with you on our show again.
Would be a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense NewsHour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.